Okay, and then I think you can use the share screen function.
I can.
Yeah.
It says host disabled participant screen sharing.
Okay, hold on one second. Okay, now try that again.
Sorry, I always get confused. All right. Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with our journal club for today, which get you to the top here. This represents the September articles. I identified 19 articles that I felt served the purposes of our journal club. These included 13 neoplastic articles, two non-neoplastic, one case report, one review, and two letters. And I'm actually have chosen to present one of those letters. It was in the Blue Journal, and it was one of the most interesting articles that I read. So I'm breaking with tradition. I'm presenting a letter. I'd like to start though by looking at the articles for notation briefly, just to highlight a few. So in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology, there are actually three articles that are about the new TNM staging for pleural mesothelioma for the ninth edition of the AJCC. So I've actually chosen to highlight one of those as an article for discussion, but two others exist. One is on end staging, and the other is kind of more a summative article. Let's see. I've also included here an article that appeared in the American Journal of Surgical Pathology on peritoneal inclusion cysts. I chose to include this since, at least for some of us, peritoneal mesothelial proliferations can sometimes come across our desks, or we may be consulted by our colleagues on these. I was a little disappointed, I have to admit, in this article, just for the reason that two of the patients that were diagnosed with multifocal peritoneal inclusion cysts suffered recurrence, and in those cases, they only performed a VAP1, which was retained. I was kind of surprised that they weren't asked to do more on those, but I wasn't the reviewer here. So anyhow, just wanted to mention that I included that one as well. Although, let's see, we had one article from the Mayo Clinic, our colleagues at Mayo, that looked at the kind of retrospectively assessed MYC copy number gain and or immunohistochemistry in patients with non-small cell lung cancers. They were looking to see if there was a predictive response for immunotherapy in those patients. So this is kind of the summary of that article that appeared in Lung Cancer. Also highlighting modern pathology, there was kind of this in-depth transcriptome analysis of sclerosing pneumocytomas, and I actually at first had selected this article to present, and then once I started getting into the weeds of it, I decided that it was better served as an article for notation. But nonetheless, I think the take-home point, this was just four cases of sclerosing pneumocytoma in which they did this in-depth analysis that included single-cell RNA sequencing and spatial transcriptomics. And kind of what we've already known to be true, at least to some extent, they found that the surface cells are reminiscent of type 1 alveolar epithelial cells, and the round cells show a mesenchymal epithelial dual phenotype. But if you want to get into all of the details of that, certainly that's nicely presented in this modern pathology article. I included here also
Can
an
I
article.
ask, did they convince you that the surface cells are neoplastic?
They said that they are.
Yeah, a lot of people have said
They
that they
said that
are. I
they're
don't believe
clonal.
any of them.
I still struggle to under believe believe and understand that, as you all
Okay.
know. So
I was
that's
just
what they
curious.
concluded. It was kind of weird the way that they did this too. It seemed like they amalgamated the cells and then separated them apart. So I'm not exactly sure what they were looking at, to be honest. I included this article from the European Respiratory Journal just to, in the event that anyone looks at pediatric lung biopsies. It was an interdisciplinary consensus, and I have to say, from a pathology standpoint, this really didn't add much, from my knowledge at least. Really, they spent the majority of time for the pathology was was talking about the optimal size and processing of surgical lung biopsies, but nonetheless included here for completeness. In human pathology, just wanted to bring you aware of this new proposed term that I suspect won't gain traction, but nonetheless is offered here to describe in three patients these fibroinflammatory lesions that they call idiopathic hyalinizing fibrosclerosis, which didn't qualify for a diagnosis of IgG4 related disease. And to my eye, looking at these cases, these just look like pulmonary hyalinizing granuloma. But nonetheless, now you've been made aware of this term. But I'd like to get started kind of with the articles for discussion. Let's see here. All right, starting with Lita's article, which is a letter in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. So I thought it was worthwhile this, talking about this because what she's presenting here is her tool that she's developed called endobronchial optical coherence tomography. And right now, this tool kind of lives with pathology and really lives with her as a pathologist. But I think that this is kind of a tool that could be taken over by radiology in the future. And it could, potentially replace biopsy. So I think it's worthwhile discussing it here and beginning kind of to learn about it and talk about it in the context in which its use is proposed. So they prospectively investigated if the presence of definite fibrosis, I'll tell you what that means later, but definite fibrosis on endobronchial optical coherence tomography predicts for progressive fibrosis in patients with interstitial lung abnormalities incidentally discovered on CT in patients undergoing resection for lung nodules. So these are all asymptomatic patients just found to have these ILAs during lung cancer imaging. This was a single center prospective, they call it a pilot study. The inclusion criteria was that these patients were incidentally discovered to have an ILA on concurrent lung nodule thin section CT. They had to be undergoing elective bronchoscopy and surgical resection, and the presence of ILA should be within and away from the planned resection. So they wanted to make sure that that ILA pathology was going to be represented in those resection specimens. Exclusion criteria, as I already alluded to, is a pre-existing diagnosis of interstitial lung disease. So they performed this endobronchial imaging during bronchoscopy, and they had pre-selected the sites for imaging based on the areas of CT abnormality. One pathologist who was blinded to the histology classified those images obtained on bronchoscopic imaging, and they kind of used this a bunch of descriptive terms that we'll look at in a moment. One of which included microscopic definite fibrosis, which is defined as subpleural and/or airway-centered fibrosis with microscopic traction bronchiectasis or honeycombing. She then compared those images were compared against histology that was interpreted by another pathologist. And I couldn't tell from this who that was or if it was a group of pathologists. Was it the original pathologist? I'm not sure, but that individual is blinded to the endobronchial imaging findings. And all of these patients were followed for at least 5 years. So eight patients met inclusion criteria. And kind of those are detailed in table one that kind of spills onto this next page. And so you just see it here. But all the patients were greater than 60 years old. The vast majority were male patients. Only one was a female patient, and all were former smokers. And to me, as we're describing this patient population, this kind of sounds like the prototypic IPF patient. Six of the eight patients, those are kind of highlighted here. I use kind of a highlight. These are the ones that progressed and two didn't. So six patients progressed. All of those had definite fibrosis on endobronchial imaging. And this presence was 100% predictive for disease progression. And so you can see here in the interpretation, it kind of has a collection of descriptive descriptions, one of which is the microscopic definite fibrosis, and then kind of those listed below. And at least in two of those patients, patients one and patient six, those were described as consistent with early UIP. And you can see here the companionate histology interpretations, which they seem to have used kind of this all of the same descriptive terms that are used in kind of the endobronchial imaging interpretation. And one thing I was a little disappointed with in these is that I struggled to understand. So does this mean that they had a fibrosing chronic interstitial pneumonia on histology? And at least looking at the collection of terms, I would think that some of these could be probable UIP, but that wasn't really fleshed out here. Just the terms were listed there. The two patients without definite fibrosis showed no radiographic or symptomatic progression, and only. Sorry, going back, not to be too schizophrenic. Only for as far as the histology, patients with from a histologic standpoint, those with honeycombing or traction bronchiectasis on histology or endobronchial imaging progressed. So I think that was interesting to me at least. So the take-home message here was that endobronchial optical coherence tomography, quote, definite fibrosis, which corresponds to histologic findings of subpleural or airway-centered fibrosis with traction bronchiectasis and/or honeycombing, predicts for disease progression with asymptomatic ILA. And I thought that this was interesting because, at least from my standpoint, not as an individual who does this imaging technique, but certainly all of us read histology, that the histology in asymptomatic patients is going to predict for disease progression if it looks like UIP. So I thought that was, for me at least, a take-home point. But I'd be interested to hear if anyone has comments about this interesting letter. Anything to add? Okay. We shall move on.
I just have one question, Christine.
Yeah.
So the idea is to identify patients who have radiologic ILA and turn out to have meaningful fibrotic lung disease as evidenced by progression. And the hypothesis for why that matters is that early treatment could make a difference. So
Right.
were they treated?
None of these patients were treated, no.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Nope. All right, moving on.
Sorry, I also had a question.
Yeah.
What was the role of the OCT here? Did they had biopsies? I'm sorry, I'm just trying to figure it out.
Yep. So
Based
they
on
just.
tissue histology.
Oh, so the tissue histology was performed. They preoperatively did this OCT, endobronchial OCT, and then they underwent their lung nodule resection, and that's where the histologic diagnoses were rendered. And then they
Okay.
followed these patients for 5 years out to see what happened.
And what was the use of the OCT then?
It was
What
just
was
that they were looking to see if it was predictive, if the presence of definite fibrosis on OCT predicted for
Okay.
progressive fibrosis.
Oh,
Which,
so they were saying that there was a good correlation between OCT and
yep.
histology.
Yep, that it was 100% predictive. And when I think here they're hoping that that they're able to do this, non-biopsy procedure and replace the need for transbronchial biopsy in these patients or any type of lung wedge biopsy and hopefully
Yeah.
select for patients who may benefit from antifibrotic therapy.
And I guess the advantage is that they can look at many, many areas of the lung with this
Yeah.
as well.
Yep,
Whereas
exactly.
a wedge, you just get a couple of wedges at the edge of the lung. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyhow, interesting. I don't think it's gonna, necessarily replace us anytime soon, but I think an it's useful for us to know about because, as I mentioned, it lives now with a pathologist, this technology and interpretation. And I could imagine that the radiologists may want to own this, and I don't know who should, but I think it's interesting nonetheless.
But doesn't it need, it's actually a respirologist would have to do this, wouldn't they, to do the.
Well, they do the procedure, but it was interpreted, the images were interpreted by a
Okay.
pathologist.
Okay. Okay.
Yep.
Does anybody have this equipment? Do you know of anybody else who uses this?
Right,
This
we.
was demonstrated in Calgary about, oh, 12 years ago. And nobody kind of took it up, but yeah.
Be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I'm just looking at like example images of what they get, and it, I mean, it looks much more like something that would come out of ultrasound than something we're accustomed to looking at. So I'm kind of surprised that pathology would jump on interpreting this.
All right, great discussion. Thank you. So moving on, this is an article out of Yale. From the authors come out of Yale, published in Modern Pathology, that I selected kind of based upon HER2 requests following FDA approval of trastuzumab deruxtecan, and just thought it would be interesting to see kind of where the future may be for HER2 interpretation. So that's why we're hearing about it right now. So these authors look to quantify HER2 expression in non-small cell lung cancers using a high sensitivity HER2 assay that they created. They wanted to establish the limits of detection, quantification, and linearity, and ultimately determine the proportion of cases with detectable HER2 levels and kind of the rationale for why this needs to be done, kind of a high sensitivity assay, is that conventional HER2 testing is not sensitive to low levels of expression that may be drug targetable. So they applied immunofluorescence antibodies for HER2 and cytokeratin to tissue microarrays of non-small cell lung cancers. They had a large cohort that they were working with. And in this cohort, they knew the clinical pathologic characteristics that included the demographics, the clinical stage at diagnosis, the tumor type, the PD-L1 status, and outcomes. Importantly, what they didn't know is they didn't know about the presence of ERBB2 genomic alterations. Their TMAs were stained in batches along with at least one calibration cell line microarray per batch. And these calibration CMAs have known expression levels of HER2. So they did image analysis and quantitative immunofluorescence. Then they took these HER2 quantitative IF scores and they converted them to units of attamoles based on the calibration curves from those CMAs that were associated with each batch. Then they were able to calculate the limit of detection, which is the lowest detectable signal that can be distinguished above noise. They also were able to determine the limit of quantification, which is the lowest signal that can be quantified with a reliable degree of de precision. And then also the limit of linearity, which is the signal level beyond which calibration curve is no longer linear. It kind of curves up. So they calculated those. And then to test kind of the determined levels, they actually ran this test multiple times on serial sections of the TMAs. And those results were compared and averaged. They also performed it kind of as this separate, it's really minimized here, and it's not clear to me even 100% why they did this, but they also did immunohistochemistry for HER2 using standard breast cancer assay and their high sensitivity assay. And the reason I say it's kind of unclear is it's not really talked about much in the results section or even the supplemental data or discussion. So the results showed high reproducibility using serially sectioned tissue. Let me show you the curve here. In total, 63% of cases had HER2 levels above the limit of detection. So the majority were above that limit of detection. And of these, 17% were between the limit of detection and the limit of quantification. And then over here is where the cases that kind of are above the curve live, the limit of linearity. So HER2 expression, they simply looked at high levels and stratified those against different clinical pathologic characteristics. There's a whole bunch of kind of tables and figures that address this, but in brief, adenocarcinomas showed higher levels of HER2 expression than squamous cell carcinomas. High HER2 expression was more common in females than males, and it was associated with PD-L1 low tumors. There was no association between HER2 expression and outcomes, and in their very brief results, they indicated that their HER2 IHC assay showed stronger staining than would be seen in kind of the standard assay. Here they are side by side, and they just show that with the standard assay, this would be scored as probably a one, and with the high sensitivity, a three. I don't know what this means because it doesn't really correlate with anything, any treatment measures. So I'm not sure what any of this means. And they didn't go into it, but kind of the conclusions here are these findings suggest that a substantial proportion of non-small cell lung cancers have detectable and quantifiable levels of HER2 expression, which offers a potential target for HER2 antibody drug conjugates. I think here I have received exactly zero HER2 requests in lung cancers, and I'm interested to know kind of what others are finding or, what the kind of the behavior of your clinicians, because at least here at Michigan, I haven't received any requests. Dr. Kelly, have you gotten any?
No, none in lung.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this
So,
seems like an assay searching for the question, right?
yeah,
Like, yeah,
exactly.
nice performance, but for what?
Exactly. So,
And is this immunofluorescent assay automated then? The pathologist doesn't score this, right?
you know what? It is automated.
Yeah.
But
I it gives it would be a nice option then to do double staining
yeah.
with this assay, because that's one of the problems with PD-L1. You sometimes don't know if you're dealing with tumor or macrophages when you're looking at lung. But otherwise, I can't see the value of it over the, I mean, the DAB staining looks pretty easy to interpret here.
I agree with you. And I don't know, what it means. And at this point, I think that they've created it and they're trying to figure that out as well. They
Yeah.
kind of conclude almost with that sentence. We look forward to applying this and figuring
Yeah.
out kind of what it means. So, anyhow, now we're aware of it. All right. Next.
We're doing HER2 in gut cancer, but stomach cancer. No one's asked for it in lung.
Yeah. The only times it's been GYN Mets from the gynecologic tract, and I'm grateful that my colleagues in gyn path say, we ordered this HER2 for you and we're going to report it. I said, perfect. Thank you. next one, I forgot to mention I kind of at the beginning of this, I have to admit I struggled a bit, although perhaps I alluded to it in the articles for notation to have articles that really spoke to me this month. But as, so I'm sorry if you're not enthused about these. Moving on to the next article, which was in Virchow's, that is looking at immunohistochemical staining patterns for YAP1 N-terminus and C-terminus in metaplastic thymomas. And really the basis of this was that YAP1 C-terminus loss is known to occur in metaplastic thymomas, and they wanted to see if YAP1 N-terminus had any utility in this setting. So they identified 14 cases of metaplastic thymoma that they applied kind of this combination of antibodies to. They also applied these stains to 104 other types of thymic epithelial tumors. the comprised tissue microarrays, as well as some additional resections that they stained. The rationale for doing the resections was to see the heterogeneity of the staining. A positive result was regarded as nuclear staining of at least 50% of cells. In metaplastic thymomas, they looked at both the spindled and epithelial components. They performed RNA sequencing for YAP1 and MAMIL2 fusion on 11 of the 14 cases of metaplastic thymomas, and FISH break apart as well. And then kind of a sub objective that is not really well explored here, but they did PAU2F3 antibody staining that was applied to the metastatic metaplastic thymomas. And I think it's because they had found that type A thymomas are positive for PAU2F3, and so they wanted to see what metaplastic thymomas did in this setting. So they found that 100% of metaplastic thymomas, here I'm going to show you the table here. Here are the metaplastic thymomas, and here are the non-metaplastic thymomas grouped together, and then these kind of split apart into their different subgroups. But 100% of metaplastic thymomas showed YAP1N positive staining and YAP1C negative. The staining that was seen for the YAP1 was less than 50% in limited to spindle cells, where it showed weak immunoreactivity. There were a subset of cases, five non-metaplastic thymomas, that showed this pattern of immunoreactivity, which included one type AB thymoma, one B2, one B3, and two thymic carcinomas. PAU2F3 was negative in all cases of metaplastic thymoma. And insofar as the RNA sequencing in FISH, it was successful in six of the 11 cases. And it failed in five of the cases due to poor DNA RNA quality in the older blocks. So that was part of the reason they felt like this immunohistochemistry could be helpful. They felt like, okay, if you needed to perform gene rearrangement and it's not possible because of these are old blocks, you could do this combination of antibodies to establish kind of this diagnosis of metaplastic thymoma, and that it would be a surrogate marker for YAP1 MAMIL2 gene rearrangement. I guess if you were going to invest in one of these antibodies, you could just get the YAP1C, since that kind of performed well alone. But not as good as both antibodies. I don't know that this is that important of a question to establish on a small biopsy, but maybe in the future it would be an important question. Does anyone have this antibody? Yeah. I think that maybe it would be of more interest to our colleagues in derm. It looks like there's some utility in pleuroma and porocarcinoma. But anyhow, just bringing this to your attention as something that exists should the question or the answer ever become important.
Yeah, we have the C terminus, but not the N.
We do
Yeah, we have the C
for
terminus
poro
for
for
derm.
that
Yeah.
exact reason. See, I didn't even know we had it because I've never worried about it, but now I know we have it if we need it. Thank you, Will.
I'm always curious, so I look it up on our list, and I'm always surprised. We have a lot of weird stuff.
But we'll need to do it next time we have a metaplastic thymoma to see what it looks like.
I just wonder though, it's such a histologically distinctive lesion with a pretty distinctive immunoprofile, so it's hard to see how adding that antibody gets you to greater diagnostic precision.
I agree with you. That's why I felt like maybe on small biopsy, but I've never really struggled with that question myself. All right, moving on to our last article. This is one of the three that I alluded to out of JTO about the TNM staging for pleural mesothelioma for the ninth edition. And I have to admit, this is not pathology driven or pathology focused. This is not going to impact us, but I do kind of think it's interesting and important for us to be aware of how these tumors are staged should questions ever arise, and to be knowledgeable in that regard. So this is really a radiology focus study. So they wanted to analyze the pleural thickness on CT and use it as well as the existing 8th edition clinical T staging descriptors to develop recommendations for inclusion into the 9th edition. And why they chose pleural thickness measurements was that these have been shown to have prognostic value. And actually, in the previous iteration, they recognized that there was prognostic value here, but they didn't have the data to make the recommendation. So kind of from between what happened between the 8th edition and the 9th edition is they started collecting patients and starting to collecting this data so that they could kind of look at it more closely once the 9th edition rolled around. Or so what they did was they collected patients between 2013 and 2022 with pleural mesothelioma to analyze the clinical parameters, CT data elements, pathologic stage, treatment, and survival. The inclusion criteria for clinical T stage was that they had to have a histologic or cytologic diagnosis of mesothelioma and have M0 disease. The inclusion criteria for pathologic T, which they did also look at here, but really it, as we'll see, is not a focus of this paper. For inclusion for the pathologic T, they had to have undergone surgical resection, have not received neoadjuvant therapy, and there had to be information regarding fissure status, if it was a T1 tumor, and we'll understand why that is later. They performed a quantitative image analysis on the CT, which meant that they needed to know the maximum fissure thickness, and fissural involvement was defined as an F max of greater than 5 millimeter. And then they divided the thorax into thirds, and they measured the maximum pleural thickness in the upper, middle, and lower hemithorax to create this sum score of those three areas. They also
And
wanted.
you remembered they must have standardized where they took those measurements.
They
Were they
did.
lateral or medial, or where
They
were
used
they?
anatomic landmarks like the aortic arch and that sort of thing to try and standardize what was upper. They also originally wanted to look at the maximum diaphragmatic thickness, but there was a lot of data missing on this, so they actually couldn't include it in their analysis. But I suspect in the future this could become something that they want to look at. They also performed qualitative image analysis, which is really the basis of the 8th edition clinical staging criteria for invasion into adjacent structures, but they excluded some of the criteria that was in the 8th edition because evidence has come out that these are not accurately assessed. So things that were excluded were non-transmural invasion of the diaphragm, invasion into the lung, and endothoracic fascia invasion. And when these were excluded, there was actually a loss of distinction between the clinical T1 and T2 tumors based on the 8th edition criteria. So this just further emphasizes why they needed to come up with kind of some new recommendations here. They performed some very in-depth statistical analysis that I tried to understand, but I only really understood the results of it. Really, this in-depth analysis was performed to maximize the differences in the overall survival among the subgroups. So they had a large number of patients that met the inclusion criteria for clinical T stage analysis, including over 1,600 patients. They had about 450 patients that met inclusion criteria for pathologic T stage. Fissural involvement was found to be an independent predictor of worse prognosis, regardless of that sum score, that P sum score. And that's why the fissure was important in pathology for the T1. So they did this recursive partitioning to find the optimal cutoffs. And they found, and that's how they came up with these scores. So they found that cutoffs of 12 and 30, oops, sorry, let me go to the recommended revisions. These scores of 12 meters and 12 millimeters and 30 millimeters. That's why those become important. And that's how the combination of that with extent of invasion yielded four prognostic subgroups. And pleural thickness, it was not included over here. You may think, okay, well, why did pleural thickness not make its way over into pathologic T stage if that's so important from an imaging standpoint? And they go into this in their discussion to say that it partially, really, the main reason is that pathology, what the way they take out these tumors, you're not going to get a faithful measurement of pleural thickness when these are actually resected, and it would be impossible for us to do these. The only change that comes in from our perspective is involvement of the fissure, so for T staging. So really nothing from our standpoint. Everything else remained the same, but a lot of changes for our radiology colleagues and the things that they need to assess when trying to stage patients with mesothelioma. So based upon the author's findings, size criteria is the sums of the maximum pleural thickness at three levels and presence or absence of fissural involvement on chest imaging are now proposed components for clinical T staging, and really no changes for us. It would just be presence or absence of fissural involvement. So I hope that you found this useful for kind of moving forward and in kind of tumor board discussions about these patients, what we'll be seeing. That's all I have.
I logged in a bit late. Did you use AI at all for the
I did not. I didn't mention it. Nope. I did it all myself because, to be quite honest, I take it as a personal challenge to distill these down, the notations down to a few sentences, and I have to read the articles anyways. Yes. So if you see all my 2-cent comments sprinkled throughout here, that was me, not a sassy AI. So no, I didn't. I did say, preparing this does take a lot of time. I would be interested to know from the people that have used the AI if it really does cut down on your time significantly. I mean, I think this took me over 12 hours to put this together when just, when you select the articles, read them and do the notations. Jeff, I think you did the AI, but you also did a little bit more. Do you think it sped you up?
I don't think it saved a ton of time, except for maybe the notation articles. To be honest, the consequence was I didn't read them as carefully as I might have otherwise. But I think in terms of the discussion articles, I didn't really have the sense that it was a time saver.
Unless you didn't read the article and just but which none of us do, so
Well, I think we actually talked about that as a potential model if folks are crunched for time, that it's still incumbent on us to understand the discussion articles. And since the others from our survey data kind of just function as bookmarks, it doesn't really matter, or it might not matter. So I don't know, I'm conflicted. I think the risk to all of that is that before you know it, the discussion articles will get the same treatment, and then we won't learn like we learn now.
Well, that was, I mean, part of this, it was interesting, as I alluded to, I was struggling to select articles a bit this month. And then when I started to get into the details of an article, I thought, well, that one isn't maybe what I wanted. And I guess if I hadn't been doing that exercise, I would have missed really good article or better articles, I should say, to pick out.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the value of the Journal Club is the thinking. And one thing that was really clear with the Chat GPT is it doesn't think, but it does summarize. So it can summarize the content available from the author and reflect the author's point of view, but it can't tell you when the author's full of crap. Or at least it chooses not to.
Maybe one day it will.
That's why I said the sassy comments in the notations, if you read them. That's not Chat GPT. Anyhow, well, thank you guys for tuning in. I really appreciate it, and I hope you
Thank
have a
you,
good day.
Christine.
Bye
Great.
bye.
Thanks,
Thank you very
Christine.
much.